professional clientele. Le Corbusier answered the letters he received, sending sketches, these letters he answered, sending sketches and preliminary budgets, and in some cases providing an actual site. While this could be the subject of another study, it is sufficient for our purpose to note that some readers of L'Esprit Nouveau became actual clients. Now, when L'Esprit Nouveau sees publication in 1925, 5 years is a lot for a magazine, Le Corbusier declared. One ought not to repeat oneself continuously. Others, younger people, will have younger ideas. Now, what is interesting here is that, I mean, I think this is a quite generous statement anyway, but Le Corbusier emerged from this experience as an established architect. You have to remember that he didn't have any work at all. I mean, it was the beginning of the 20s, and nobody had, but he emerged as a clearly established architect. And in many ways, you can say that this maturation process was abetted by his production of the review and the nature of the audience he was reaching. Now, statistics in a letter to the Atelier Primavera, which is a subsidiary of the Primetown department store, that were done in an effort to obtain an advertisement contract with them, state that only 24.3 of L'Esprit Nouveau subscribers were artists, painters and sculptors. The rest comprised what Le Corbusier will call people occupying active positions in society. That's what he says in the letter. Architects, of course, are included in the last category, together with doctors, lawyers, teachers, engineers, industrialists, and bankers. Financing for the magazine, you can see the page on the right, which was also Le Corbusier's responsibility to produce, also came largely from industrialists and bankers, many from Swiss origins. And Le Corbusier's understanding of the media also secured his review a place in the international architectural circuits. A map that was published in L'Esprit Nouveau number 17 shows the distribution of subscribers by country of origin. Le Corbusier and Ozan Fan even attempted at one point to come out with an English language version of the review, but L'Affaire Américaine, as they themselves called the project, was never realized. L'Esprit Nouveau, as you can see on the right, was part also of an exchange network with avant-garde magazines such as Ma, Estava, The Steel, Beige, and others. Correspondence in the Fundation Le Corbusier illuminates Le Corbusier's relation with Lissitzky, Ilya Ehrenburg, Walter Gropius, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, Theo van Doesburg, Karel Tige, and others. But perhaps the most telling document in this respect, not only at a symbolic level, is a card. These are the correspondence, by the way. The most telling document, however, I think, is this one, which is a card that Siegfried Gideon wrote to Le Corbusier in 1925, mentioning that he was preparing a book on modern architecture and that Moholy-Nagy had recommended that he visited Le Corbusier. We can already see in this the network, precisely, of the avant-garde engaged in their own historical legitimation, something that Gideon will carry out in full scale as the first operative critic of the modern movement. Now, what do I mean by operative critic? This is a concept, of course, taken by Frontafuri, who writes, what is normally meant by operative criticism, but this is very much Tafuri's ways of writing. He really should say what I mean by operative criticism, but he says, what is normally meant by operative criticism, is operative criticism or something that we all knew about it, but it's a very interesting concept on the other hand. What is normally meant by operative criticism is an analysis of architecture or of the arts in general that instead of an abstract survey has as its objective the planning of a precise poetical tendency anticipated in its structure and derived from historical analysis programmatically distorted and finalized. Well, if you get through this way of writing, what he is really saying is that there is a difference between the somewhat objective ways of, if there is such a thing, of writing a history and those represented by Gideon, for example, who have a precise idea of what he wanted to communicate. Now, what is interesting here is that the relations between operative criticism and a consumerist culture are also clear. differences are cancelled by the process of labeling, for example, and the product in turn becomes marketable. Modern architecture does not simply address or exploit mass culture, it is itself from the beginning a commodity. Perhaps nowhere this is made more explicit than with the exhibition Modern Architecture in the Museum of Modern Art and the book that accompanied it, The International Style Architecture Since 1922. So with this we move to the third part, which is about the MoMA exhibition, the famous exhibition. Well, I think it's famous in the end. It's the international style, because I have noticed that many people don't realize that the catalog, for example, was not called international style, it was called modern architecture. And that actually the catalog and the book, the international style, do not coincide. So here you have the cover of the catalog modern architecture. Actually, it was red. It is red in the letters. And a shot of the exhibition with the work of Le Corbusier in this particular picture. Now, when the modern movement finally arrived in America with the exhibition Modern Architecture, created by Henry Russell Hitchcock and Philip Johnson, and the subsequent bestseller, one may say, The International Style, by the same author, Le Corbusier's engagement with mass culture will seem to have been erased in the translation. His work, as well as that of the other figures of the modern movement, is understood only in aesthetic terms and reduced to a style, the void that is of its social, ethical, and political content. The violence of this translation is by now common knowledge, but I think that today the question of style needs to be re-examined in terms of the play between high and mass culture that we have been following here. The museum presented the American public with a cultural reality that was already long in place. While promoting modernity, the present, they state repeatedly that the international style already exists in the present, the exhibition was in fact a retrospective. Our book, they write, was written looking backwards at the preceding 10 years. That is, the present then was actually the written past, but a past that did not simply project into the future. Again, they write, or does Johnson write in much later, the international style, of course, this is something most people don't realize, was almost over in 1932, but I was not conscious of that. History, you can be conscious of, but you can possibly know what you are doing as you go along. Now, these sentiments are very reminiscent of Le Corbusier when he writes, for example, our epoch is determining day by day its own style, our eyes unhappily are unable to discern it. But where for Le Corbusier this contemporary style was to be found precisely in the everyday object and the industrial product, that is, in the unconscious, anonymous design, for Johnson and Hitchcock, the international style was specifically established by a few masters and masterpieces, what they call the canon of executed works. In their book, they write, the four leaders of modern architecture are Le Corbusier, Wood, Gropius, and Mies van der Rohe. And in his foreword to the 1966 edition, Hitchcock congratulates himself on how timely the book has turned out to be, and he says, had we written it several years before, as I had my modern architecture of 1929, the canon of executed works on which our designation of the style was based would have been seriously incomplete. For the two finest houses in the new style, Le Corbusier Villa Savoie and Mies Tugendhat House, will not have yet existed. End of the quote. Now, for Le Corbusier, which is concerned with the everyday, the new style is everywhere, in all these catalogs, in all these images, and for that reason, difficult to discern. For Johnson, who is concerned with the exclusive moments of high culture, the difficulty is that the international style necessarily dies in the very moment that is canonized. The international style was over in 1932, as he says, because it never existed outside of its representation, that is, the exhibition and its accompanying publication. It both came into being and ended with its consumption in a sea of publicity. The moment the practice of some architects was labeled international style and identified by its insertion in the museum as high art, it necessarily left that domain to be disseminated in and as popular culture. And this is the paradox. The moment it was canonized, it became mass culture. And that's what I'm trying to demonstrate in what follows. It is important in this respect to consider the role that the institution, the Museum of Modern Art, played in the construction of the international style. The museum was obviously collecting as art the materials of the architects of the modern movement, the exhibition, a bit the drawing, the plans, all these things that were not considered up to the point as art. They were considered as, you know, documents of their projects. The exhibition Modern Architecture and the book International Style indeed in the end provided the museum with a department of architecture headed by Johnson, not by accident, only 2 years after opening its door, after the Museum of Modern Art opened its door. In these terms, the institution was only able to construct itself by detaching the modern movement from everyday life so that it became available for appropriation by high culture. The curators established this dichotomy between art and life, the artwork and the everyday object. And by the way, these are distinctions, and when you come to architecture are different than those you make in art. They do it precisely in architecture by maintaining a clear hierarchy between architecture and building, between the aesthetic and the technical or sociological. For example, here is an interview that Johnson gave, I think it was with Peter Eisenman, in 1982. And he writes, this is Johnson writing, "The last sentence in our book is the only important one, the book being the international style. We have an architecture still, because the functionalists deny it. We wrote that book in a fury against the functionalist German social democratic workers' approach to architecture as part of a social revolution. We thought that architecture was still an art, that it was something you could look at, that therefore architects should not be worried about the social implications, but about whether the world looked good or not. In that sense, we had only 3 allies in the modern movement, Le Corbusier, Oud, and Mies. Talking to Gropius was a dead end, because he will still mouth the Gideon-esque platitudes of social discipline and revolution. That is, in Le Corbusier's phrase, if you have enough glass walls to become free." Now, against the architects and critics of functionalism, or those who claim that the modern world, that's them speaking, the modern world has neither the time nor the money required to raise buildings to the level of architecture, those are Hannes Meyer and Gideon, for example, Hitchcock and Johnson contend that these arguments are not valid in the contemporary world outside of Russia. And they write, "Whether they ought or not, many clients can still afford architecture in addition to building." These clients are, of course, those who can also afford art. But while the museum distorted modern architecture's engagement with everyday life in this way, there is another sense in which they understood that engagement much more clearly than anyone else. The clarity is, of course, not contained in the specific account of Le Corbusier in the written text or the particular images they choose. Rather, it is in their thorough understanding of the media, the exhibition and the catalogue and the book. And in this particular sense, they were, I think, following very closely Le Corbusier. Look at this example, for example. This is Alfred Barr, the founding director of the museum. And he's introducing the catalogue with the following sentence: "Expositions and exhibitions have perhaps changed the character of American architecture of the last 40 years more than any other factor." End of the quote. So that is, he proclaims from the start that exhibitions are far more effective than school, newspapers, magazines, and of course the actual practice of building in shaping American architecture. That's what he's saying. In other words, you can say exhibitions are more public than buildings. This sensitivity to the media is also evident in his introduction to the book International Style, where he laments the chaos and confusion of contemporary American architecture, a confusion that significantly he reads not in the real city, as one may expect it, but as represented in 2 American magazine articles. These 2 American magazine articles, one is called New Building for the New Age, which is supposedly representative of what is happening in Europe, and another one called Poets in Steel, which is an article on modern American architecture. And Barth argues that the confusion in American architecture is first of all a confusion of public opinion, And in this sense, modern architecture, the exhibition, and the book, The International Style, were set up precisely as publicity campaigns aimed to change that opinion. In fact, as Terry Riley has pointed out, The International Style was conceived first as a book and only later as an exhibition, something that not many people know. The initial plan was precisely to rewrite Hitchcock's Modern Architecture of 1929 in a more popular way and with more illustrations. Barr has reviewed the book before Hitchcock and Johnson sailed for Europe, and while praising it as a scholarly achievement, also found it too erudite for the general reader and parsimonious in its illustrations. It was in great part due to publishing difficulties that the idea of the exhibition emerged. "No one wants another book on modern architecture here in Germany," wrote Johnson in a letter to his mother in July of 1930. "In vain do we explain that there has been no book covering the whole style and nothing but the style." In December of 1930, the first proposal for an exhibition was presented. So once they have failed to produce the book, the exhibition happened. Now, from the beginning, the organizers proclaimed their commitment to publicity. In their proposal to the museum, they write, "Publicity for the show," this is directly from their proposal, "will be extensive. Besides announcements and comments in newspapers and magazines, the general appeal of the show, it is safe to assume, will attract further attention from architects, engineers, industrialists, builders, as well as the general public. The experimental nature of the show, coupled with its timely appearance, will undoubtedly provoke lively and fruitful controversy. So they were also counting on the controversy as part of their publicity. The importance of the catalogue is also stressed as a propagandistic, in their own words, tool rather than merely documentary source. In addition, they point to its permanent value over the relatively ephemeral value of the exhibition. But even the exhibition, they insist, will be multiplied by having it travel extensively through the United States. In fact, after its closing in the MoMA, I don't know whether you know that, it traveled for about 7 years. A further attempt was made to engage the general public with a series of lectures by Hitchcock and Johnson that were planned from the beginning and offered throughout the country. They sent millions of letters to all kinds of institutions offering these lectures, even indicating how much they will charge and everything. You know, they send them. And what is interesting here is that they were not offering, and they didn't give it only in museums and other art institutions, as you may expect, but also, and significantly, at department stores such as Sears, Roebuck Company in Chicago, and the Bullocks in Los Angeles. And it's also interesting, I don't know whether you know that the exhibition also traveled to these department stores. It did not only travel to museums and other art institutions. Just as Le Corbusier had attended, this actually is a sort of the exhibition in the Museum of Modern Art, I believe, but that one is another. I think it's the one in Chicago, the Sears. Anyway, in the same way that Le Corbusier had attempted through L'Esprit Nouveau to engage French department stores in his battle for modernizing the house, so were Johnson and Hitchcock trying to break into the highly conservative middle-class market of the home. Johnson was very, very vocal in this respect. He wrote, in the documents trying to convince the museum about his point, he says that the most interesting exhibit for the public is still that of the private house. The private house, therefore, was singled out as the vehicle for precisely the popularization of the style, and therefore made into a privileged item in the exhibition. Johnson arrives to the point of enticing architects to present houses by offering more space in the exhibition to those that did. He writes, "I wish to have as many private houses as I can. Indeed, I am thinking of suggesting to the architects that they may submit more than one model if one of them is a private house." So the International Style will end up being almost entirely domestic architecture. Franz Jurij, for example, will present the model of his project for the house on the Mesa, and photographs of the Robbie House, the Robert House, the Miller House, and the Jones House. Le Corbusier will present the model of the Villa Savoie, and photographs of the Beestegui apartment, the Villa Stein, and the double house and at the Weissenhof colony. Now, this is, of course, the model in the Museum of Modern Art. That is another picture that I brought here because I think it's interesting, because it's not only the apartments of Le Corbusier in the Weissenhof, but it's, of course, not the image that is used by the museum, which in the images of the museum there are never figures. But I found this image recently, and it's very interesting because, you see, I've always talked about the way in which Le Corbusier always has cars in the photographs of his houses, so that it becomes unclear whether it's the car who is being advertised or the house. And this is a real advertisement. This is Mercedes-Benz advertising his latest model, and Le Corbusier's house is the backdrop. So, because we were talking about publicity, I brought this one. For all they presented the model of the project for a house at Pinehurst, that is from the family of Johnson, I believe. Then Mies presented the Tugendhau house and photographs also of the Lange house, the Johnson apartment, and also the Barcelona Pavilion, which you can argue that is a domestic project, if not a house. So you can say that the whole international style is domestic architecture, that modern architecture is modest, something that is not quite so much stressed in many ways. And that was very deliberate. Now, if the international style is to be thought as a publicity campaign for modern architecture, this publicity is aimed at a public that is much larger than that which can afford art. The department store public, middle class, and mainly woman. It is not just the house that is for sale in these promotions. After all, the Department of Architecture that emerged from the exhibition is the Department of Architecture and Design. The international style publicizes the private, not simply because it exhibits the private houses of some art collectors, but because it offers that image for mass consumption in the form of the multiple, relatively affordable designer objects that are part of it, rugs, chairs, lamps, tables, appliances, and so on. And of course, now it's even more clear when in the Museum of Modern Art, not only you can see these objects in exhibit, but you can also buy them in their store. But I think what is interesting here is that this was already operating in this early moment, something that now may be obvious. Le Corbusier had already argued, you may remember that, in L'Art Décoratif d'aujourd'hui, that art was everywhere, in the street, in the city, but missing at home. His own campaign was precisely aimed at bringing the house up to speed with the 20th century. The MoMA effectively achieved some of that goal. Even Mumford, traditionally a spokesman for the city, was extremely articulate in his assessment of the relevance of the private house. In his chapter on housing in the original catalogue, Modern Architecture International Exhibition, a chapter that will no longer be represented in the international style book, Mumford writes, "The building of houses constitutes the major architectural work of any civilization. During the past 100 years, the conditions of wildlife have been completely transformed, but it's only during the last generation that we have begun to conceive of our new domestic environment, which will utilize our technical and scientific achievements for the benefits of human living. The laying down of a new basis for housing has been, since 1914, one of the chief triumphs of modern architecture. With the return of the," he continues to write, "with the return of the entertainment to the home through the mechanical invention of the phonograph, the radio, the motion picture, and the near prospect of television, the house has made up by gains in recreational facilities what it has lost through the disappearance of early household industries. Hence, the proper design of the house has a new importance in that with greater leisure for the whole community, more time will probably be spent between its walls." Now, if for Johnson the modern house was to be publicized through the media apparatus put in motion by the museum, what Mumford identified here is that the modern house has itself been transformed through its incorporation of the media. The house is now a media center, a reality that will forever transform our understanding of both public and private. Here, Mumford is closer to Le Corbusier than he would ever want to imagine. Even his invocation of the year 1914 could never have been casual. It resonates with Le Corbusier's own identification of modern architecture with war. the modern house being constructed by recycled military technology, which includes those of the media. Furthermore, the architects of the media event, Barr, Johnson, and Hitchcock, understood their publicity campaign as a military campaign. Throughout the book, a military rhetoric is used. They write, "American nationalists will oppose this style as another European invasion." And later they say, "Nevertheless, the international style has already gained signal victories in America, as is proven by a glance of the illustration of the skyscrapers of Hove and Lescas. In Europe, too," they say, "Peter Behrens and Mendelssohn have both gone over to the international." You see all these, many other military terms, right? The book is conceived as a publicity weapon to disseminate modern architecture in America. Images are used as admonition. The text is completely subordinated to the carefully chosen image. They write, "As in this book, the text itself is intended as an introduction to the illustrations, one need scarcely speak at length about them. The authors have spent nearly 2 years in assembling the photographic and documentary material from which the illustrations were chosen. Complete projects in this particular book, as you know, are taken with one decisive shot, an advertising image that becomes as canonic as the building itself if it does not, in fact, take cover." In this terms, we can conclude that the museum was particularly sensitive to Le Corbusier's engagement with the mass media. They write, "The man who first made the world aware that a new style was being born was Le Corbusier. The influence of Le Corbusier was the greater because of the vehement propaganda which he contributed to the magazine L'Esprit Nouveau in 1920-1925. Since then, moreover, he has written a series of books effectively propagandizing his technical and aesthetic theories. For that reason, it is that the institution, the Museum of Modern Art, used Le Corbusier as a publicist. As he recounts, that is, Le Corbusier recounts in his book, My Work, 1935, this is when he's going back to recapitulate on his life work. He gets to 1935 and he writes, 1935, invitation from Rockefeller, Museum of Modern Art, for a program of 23 lectures on architecture and town planning in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Chicago, and elsewhere. 400 yards of architectural sketches in charcoal and colored chalk on 6 rolls of paper that were cut into 186 sheets, approximately 6 feet by 4 feet, in the course of this tour around America." This is true, actually. They were in, he was in Princeton, and we still have these pieces. He used to lecture making all these drawings, and we kept the roll of paper. So in the course of this tour of America, 12 years later, he keeps talking, he keeps recapitulating on these years. In June of 1947, Mr. Nelson Rockefeller said to Le Corbusier, this is Le Corbusier saying that Mr. Rockefeller said to Le Corbusier at a private dinner at his home near Central Park, "You were the man who changed the face of architecture in the United States in 1935. But Le Corbusier did not really change the face of architecture in the United States significantly. His influence was really in the techniques of representing and promoting architecture, in my opinion. The international style was a myth sustained by the strategic deployment of mass culture advertising techniques. Le Corbusier's concern with these techniques was thus returned to the country from which they have originated without being identified as such." Thus, in conclusion, while the basic account of modern architecture provided by the international style isolated it from everyday life and thereby suppressed its political agenda, as many critics have pointed out, in fact, the publicity campaign launched by the Museum of Modern Art returned, paradoxically, modern architecture to everyday life by transforming it into a commodity, a fashion, to be consumed by a worldwide and, to a larger extent, middle-class market. After all, the fact that the international style was not simply a representation of already existing architecture but a production parallels Le Corbusier's own role as producer, as publicist. Perhaps that is why, despite the clear mistranslation of his work, the vocal Le Corbusier never complained about it publicly in the same way that Franjo Wright so famously did. Indeed, the very success of the exhibition in disseminating modern architecture throughout the world to such an extent that it became anonymous can be argued to be a realization of one of Le Corbusier's earliest dreams, as he had articulated it in the years of L'Esprit Nouveau. Thank you.